Welcome to another round of Drawing Board or Miro Board. Today we discuss technical diagramming with systems architect Maya. Let's go. First question. You've spent 10 hours slogging over a sequence diagram that should have taken 5. Drawing Board or Miro Board?
Drawing Board. And if I'm being honest, Miro would probably cut that time down by half. You know, with its AI tools and ready-to-go templates.
Next, your diagrams become so bulky, it's more complex than the solar system. But all it takes is a few clicks and...
It's Miro. I've used those technical shape packs way too many times, and stuff is just digestible on its infinite online canvas.
Now, the final question. Everyone's brought in, but you have to make all these tasks all the way over in Jira. But wait, it's done. Is it...
Miro, easy with its two-way Jira sync. Easy to plot dependencies. Everyone always knows what's up.
And she's done it.
Join over 60 million people creating technical diagrams without workflow glitches. Get your first 3 boards for free at Miro.com. That's Miro.com.
The Future Proof Podcast from News Talk.
Proudly supported by Science Foundation Ireland. Hashtag believe in science.
Hello and welcome to Future Proof the Podcast. This is the show where we take a closer look at the world around us. I'm Jonathan McRae. Thank you for subscribing, downloading, rating. We really appreciate it. Let people know about the show. Share a link or send them a messenger pigeon or something. We do appreciate you letting people know about the show. That's how we grow, both in figures and spiritually. Coming up on this week's episode, we'll be talking about the tiny but also not tiny problem of moon dust and how it's a big headache for anyone trying to land on the moon or take off from it. We'll also be going through your comments and texts from last week's episode. But first, it's time to look back at the week's science news. Dr. Ruth Freeman from Science Foundation Ireland and Dr. Shane Bergen from UCD join me via Skype. You're both very welcome. Our first story.
Waiting here seems like years, never seen the light of day.
Has to do with blastoids, Ruth.
Yes, it does. And blastoids, people might be wondering, what are they? And a blastoid is a clump of cells, a tiny little clump of cells, and they've been made artificially in the lab this week by scientists in two really groundbreaking papers published in Nature. So one group is in Texas and one group is in Australia in Monash University. And these groups have used two different methods to create these little balls of cells, which very closely resemble a blastocyst. And people might have heard the term blastocyst because that's what we call a 1 week old embryo. And a blastocyst is about 100 cells, 150 cells, but those cells have started to organize in those early sort of laying down the groundwork for becoming a human being and are just ready to implant into the wall of the uterus. And these blastoids that have been created are showing a lot of those same characteristics. They're sort of trying to implant in the side of the cell culture vessel where they are being created, and even starting to show those early signs of blending with the placenta, which is what a blastocyst would do. It would start to merge with the mother's tissue to create the placenta to keep the embryo surviving. So, I mean, scientists have worked on this for a while, but this is a real, really big step forward.
Is this a new term, blastoids? Because we weren't able to do this before. So is this a new invention?
It is a new invention. So people were using the term embryoid before because scientists were getting very, very earlier stage sort of pseudo embryos created. But actually one group calls them iBlastoids and one group calls them blastoids. But obviously they've been working together and they published together. But they did use different techniques. The group in Texas, which is led by a guy called Jun Wu, initially used human embryonic stem cells. So obviously, I mean, of course, one of the fascinating things about this story is the kind of ethical ramifications of this work, which I'm sure we'll get into now. But a lot of the early work with embryoids used cells that were taken from IVF embryos that were no longer needed. And of course, that happens under very, very strict controls in only some countries. But what's happened here is that the scientists have used induced pluripotent stem cells, which are adult cells which have sort of been sent back in time. So they've been treated with chemicals to take them back to their early state where they could become lots of different kinds of cells.
Yeah, and you can get these iPSCs from skin, right?
From skin. And actually they did use skin. The group in Australia used skin cells here. Yeah.
Yeah. So now we have what seems to be a way of creating these cells, which are otherwise very difficult to study. Either they're in utero, which obviously is not somewhere you study things without huge risk, or you have to get them as the discarded embryos or cells from patients undergoing IVF, which of course aren't in huge supply. But this would sort of create a way of mass producing these really fascinating bunches of cells that could teach us a lot about how infertility happens, how complications happen, and so on. This is quite a big story.
You're right, John, and that's exactly what the scientists are working towards. I mean, they call those early stages of development in humans a black box, because you're right, we actually don't know what's happening at that molecular and cellular level, because you just can't study it. So this does potentially allow, you know, looking to see what happens with early miscarriage. We know a lot of miscarriages happen in those first 2 weeks, so can we understand better what's going on? But also even thinking about drugs and pregnant women, you know, there's no systems to look at maybe developing for pharmacological interventions which need to happen during pregnancy. There's no models out there.
But blastocysts originate with a fertilized egg, right?
Yes.
So these blastoids, has there been a fertilization artificially between two cells to create them? Or, you know, what happens if these cells, I'm sure people are thinking, what happens if these cells continue to grow?
Well, I think that the answer to the first part is no, there is no fertilization. So what the scientists noticed was, when they were working with these iPSCs, or induced pluripotent stem cells, is that on the journey of being reprogrammed, the cells went through different phases, and they saw different types of cells. And some of those looked like the three main types of cells that you get in blastocysts. And they saw this independently. And what they found was, when they cultured those types of cells together in the right medium and in the right sort of special 3D containers to give them space to clump together, they actually clumped together to form these blastoids. So it's a completely different process to what normally happens in fertilization. I mean, as to whether these blastoids could go on to produce a living, viable human, the researchers are saying no, they don't believe so at this point. But also they have abided by the international stem cell research guidelines, which have been put in place by scientists, which is to not let a human embryo grow beyond 14 days.
Nice.
So they have not let these things develop beyond that time frame.
Wow, really fascinating. Okay, our second story, Shane, has to do with the Oumuamua asteroid. I don't know what it is anymore, but it's an unusual object that passed through our orbit, which has been sort of throwing up lots of questions as to where it came from.
Yeah, so what we can say is it's an interstellar visitor, so it is not of this solar system. And we reported it on this program last year when scientists were trying to figure out whether it was an asteroid or a comet. An asteroid being a small rocky object that orbits the sun, and a comet also orbits the sun, but is made instead of ice and dust and not of metal.
Solid rock, yeah.
Solid rock, exactly. So it turns out these guys in Arizona State University did quite a lot of work on the very limited data that we have, and they fed that into various computer models, and they said it's most likely made out of solid nitrogen, and it's a shard of solid nitrogen that
wow.
most likely came from a planet similar to Pluto, in that it would have a surface of solid nitrogen. It was removed from that planet, they reckon, through some sort of impact half a billion years ago, and that since then it has been traveling from there to here, here being our solar system, and that it's lost an awful lot of its mass on the way. Now, that's great, but there are a lot of assumptions being made in this paper, and that's okay. You know, it has been peer reviewed, and they're not making guesses. They're making assumptions, and then they're seeing how they feed into their models. But it isn't entirely tied down. This is a story that continues to evolve. So it's very, very interesting work.
Yeah, it's a very unusual looking object, big oblong looking thing. And while it's not likely to pass by again, Shane, am I right? It's not likely
No.
to pass us by again. It certainly caused quite a stir because of its path, its size, and its composition. We got just a short glimpse of it, and it's been causing lots of people to scratch their heads since.
Absolutely. So last year we said it was cigar-shaped. So since then we've been able to look a little closer, and this 45-meter object is instead disc-shaped, or cookie-shaped. And that's only kind of leading to more speculation that it may be something artificial and that it might be alien in some way. I think the scientists in Harvard who are putting that forward perhaps have watched Independence Day a little bit too often.
Our third story, Ruth, has to do with eye colour. And this is something that I remember being taught in school as being something that was a sort of handed down by your parents in a very straightforward way. And it turns out it's not straightforward at all.
You're right, John. And actually that original, we all learnt, any of us that did genetics, that blue eyes are recessive and brown eyes are dominant. And it was a sort of what we call in genetics a simple trait, and it was passed on in that way. And to be fair, over the last couple of decades, researchers have worked out that it's more complicated than that. And they've identified up until this week about a dozen genes that are involved in eye colour. And not surprisingly, some of the main genes involved are the ones that code for the protein melanin, which we all hear about in terms of it's in our skin and you know it's the protein that helps you tan. But there's different varieties of melanin, and the ratio of those two types of melanin is one of the big factors that influence your eye color. But this week a paper was published from researchers in King's College in London and in Erasmus University in Rotterdam, and they've done an enormous study of the genomes of almost 200,000 people, and they've massive geographical representation, which I think has been really good, because a lot of the studies on eye color have focused on Europeans, because of course we see such variation in European eye color, and they've actually found over 50 different genes that are involved in coding for eye color, and these genes are involved in all sorts of fascinating things, if you will. So things like the structural shape of the iris, you know, the depth of the crevices in the iris, you know, the quantity of extracellular factor. So things around in the eye that might be scattering light coming in, which obviously it has an impact on our perception of color. So it's a huge piece of work that has identified all these genes. And I think for those of us working in genetics or in the field, you know, I mean, I have to say, I felt a little bit overwhelmed reading this. I mean, if you think about then going on to try and understand the brain, because of course, some of these genes are the genes that are coding for proteins or, you know, creating those shapes in the iris. But there's a lot of genetic code in here, which is turning things on and off and turning things up and down, different levels of things. So of course, if you multiply that by 50, you're getting into massive complexity very, very fast. So I just, as I was reading it, I just kept thinking, I feel so sorry for all the neuroscientists who probably have this by another factor of 1,000 to deal with if they're trying to understand the brain.
Is this not the way typically we've gone with genetics over the past, 50 years, that every time we look more closely, we realize actually it's a bit more complicated or a lot more complicated than we thought?
Exactly. I mean, honestly, I think I would cringe looking back at some of my college genetics textbook with the simplicity and certainty that we thought we had once we sequenced the human genome. So I think if I took anything out of this paper, it was a little bit of humility, but it was a great piece of work.
I mean, computers are getting much more complicated, and so they can maybe identify or model how these things work a bit better. Certainly the optimism that we might have had 20 years ago with how one day we might be able to solve this problem, it was based on flawed understanding of how simplistic this was. But at the same time, computers have become more powerful and more complicated. So maybe they're...
Yeah, exactly. And I mean, this is the kind of problem you could imagine quantum computing being used to tackle, these incredibly complex problems with huge amount of degrees of freedom and, you know, many, many different things that have to be modeled. So, yeah, absolutely. You can see a big intersection here with ICT research and genetics research, which, to be fair, has been there for a long time.
There is the issue that I know that I remember listening to a fantastic podcast about our limits of understanding. There have been computer models done where there's been patterns emerged, but the people are not able to understand what those patterns mean. So there may be a limit on how much we can actually, how much meaning we can make from the data that comes out. We need to be careful.
Yeah.
We don't just, apply a narrative to things that come out and say, well, that must be whatever,
My brain is
correlation,
full.
Causation.
Yeah.
Our final story, Shane, has to do with mind blindness.
Yeah, something I'd never heard of, and seemingly it affects 2.5% of the population. It's called aphantasia, and it's the inability to visualize mental images. So if you're reading a fiction story, that you can have the movie in your head, as it were. And so some scientists in the University of New South Wales have done a study, that show that people with this mind blindness are harder to spook with a scary story. What they have done here is, it is ridiculous. What they have done is that they have tested the role of this visual imagery for fear response. And they took 46 people, 22 of whom have aphantasia, the rest who do not. And they put them in a dark room and they told them a scary story and they measured the fear response, which is measured by skin conductivity. In other words, how much you're sweating as a result of being told the scary story. And they found that there was a far greater response for those who didn't have aphantasia. So in order to discount people's basic fear response, as in maybe I get scared quicker than Jonathan does, they then showed them images that were scary. And they found that the two groups had the same response for images, but different responses for stories. And so they postulate that that difference is accounted for by the fact that the people with aphantasia aren't able to make the visions in their head. And that has a sort of an emotional response. I think this sort of stuff is not great science. I'm just going to say that. Yeah.
It seems plausible enough, though, as a theory, right? If you can't visualize something, I mean, you just heard of this yesterday. I mean, aphantasia is a thing. So if people are listening at home and I ask you to imagine a red car crashing into a blue wall, if you can't sort of see that in your mind's eye, you may have this thing, aphantasia. And of course, if you're listening to a story and you can't visualize it, then of course it's going to be more scary. I would have thought. I mean,
It may be. It's just that I don't think this is a good way to measure that. There's an awful lot more to it, and this is a little bit simplistic. And as Ruth just suggested, our minds and our brains are a lot more complex than we think they are.
Dr. Shane Bergen and Dr. Ruth Freeman, thanks very much. Now, with no gravity or atmosphere to speak of and temperatures lurching from minus 127 to minus 173 centigrade, the moon is a dangerous place. But that being said, certain death, if exposed to its environment, isn't stopping us from trying to get there. Far from it. But there is one tiny thing that might put a spanner in the works if we ever want to set up on the moon, and it's not the lack of oxygen or radiation. Dr. Philip Metzger is a planetary scientist at the Florida Space Institute from the University of Central Florida. He joins me now. Welcome to the program, Philip.
Hello, glad to be here.
When people think about what the biggest challenge to landing on the moon, working on the moon, setting up bases and having things work that we could possibly explore further, dust is not something that people would first think of, I would imagine.
No, but it was. It became really apparent during the Apollo program that it's a major issue. In fact, some of the astronauts, including Jack Schmidt, who walked on the moon, have said that it is the largest problem to exploring the moon.
Why dust? Tell me about the surface of the moon and what it's made of and what we know about it.
Yeah, so the environment of the moon makes it very different than the Earth. Here on the Earth, we have an atmosphere that maintains liquid water at the surface. So we have rain, and that rain washes the dust out of the environment. It cleans out the sand, it cleans out the soil, and then the dust runs down the rivers into the ocean, into shallow seas where it settles to the bottom as mud, and then it eventually turns into mudstone. So there's a geological process to constantly take dust out of the environment. But on the moon, that doesn't exist. Instead, because of the lack of an atmosphere, there is constant infall of micrometeoroids busting apart the rock and creating more and more dust. So some places on the moon, the dust might be as much as 20 or 40% of the bulk of the soil. If you grab a handful of soil, the dust is all mixed in throughout it, and it's just pervasive.
In terms of, I mean, I know nothing about the size of a typical dust particle, but the size of moon dust is an issue.
Yeah, so the dust particles here on the Earth are, they're typically 1 to 10 microns, but they're not that abundant. And your body is really good at filtering them out of your lungs. So when you breathe in, the mineral dust that are smaller than 10 microns are so rare. And they just get caught in the mucus, in the inner workings of your breathing system, and your body takes them back out. But on the moon, we've got lots and lots of dust between 1 and 10 microns, which is able to follow the airflow so precisely that it gets through all the defenses of your body. It gets down into the very bottom of your lungs, and it'll be there for the rest of your life because your body has no way of getting it out. And so that can cause long-term health problems.
Did we see this in any of the astronauts that came back from the moon?
There were some temporary effects. They had some wheezing. They described it as symptoms similar to hay fever. But fortunately, we've never had anybody exposed to it so much that it built up to being a lifelong condition. However, in the laboratories where we work, we're very worried about it. We take extreme precautions to make sure that we don't breathe the simulated lunar dust that we're working with.
Simulated lunar dust? You created fake lunar dust?
Yeah, it's actually a little bit of an industry. There are a lot of groups around the world trying to create the best fake lunar dust. And
really?
It's really hard. Yeah, it's true. I was part of a team that was from the European Space Agency as well, developing their own European lunar simulants. And I'm a part of a group here at the University of Central Florida that has our own little industry of creating simulated lunar dust. We call it the Exolith Laboratory. But the geology is so exotic on the moon, it's really difficult to create that in a laboratory. And you can tell when you look at the fake lunar dust, you can say, oh, that's not very good fake lunar dust, because it takes hundreds of thousands of dollars to make really good fake lunar dust.
What? What is so special about lunar dust? And why is it not just rock shavings, or what is it?
Well, because on the moon, with the lack of an atmosphere, there's interplanetary dust constantly bombarding the surface of the moon. And when it hits the surface, it's coming in at thousands of meters per second. And that causes vaporization and melting of the material. And then that molten material splatters and it glues together, it cements together lots of other little rock particles inside of a matrix of glass. But also because the moon is constantly showered with hydrogen from the sun, the chemistry is a very, we call it chemically reducing. And so whenever you get any of this molten stuff, the hydrogen wants to combine with the oxygen and it takes the oxygen away, and that creates little bits of free metal. So inside this glass, there are tiny little specks of metal which are magnetic. And trying to replicate, we call those nanophase iron, but trying to replicate that in a laboratory is very expensive. And also the vaporization that occurs causes vapor deposition on top of the surfaces of all the dust grains. And so there's a little glass coating on top of every dust grain that gives it unique electrostatic properties.
Okay. And that leads us to the second problem beyond human health. This dust is persistent. And when you can't get to the moon without machines, and this dust is a problem.
That's right. It gets into the crevices of your machinery. It gets into the mechanism and jams them up. It causes abrasion and wears things out. Things will break. And it will coat your solar cells. It will coat your radiators so that you can't get rid of heat from your machinery. It's just a persistent problem everywhere you look.
I've been to Burning Man 3 times, and it kind of reminds me of the dust there, which gets everywhere and is very difficult to get rid of. But of course, in space on a lunar mission, it's not like you can clean it away to somewhere, right? It's not like you can clean away a surface and work in that surface because it's everywhere on the surface.
Well, we do want to keep it out of the insides of our spacecraft. So we're trying to develop methods to avoid tracking it in so that we will have clean spaces. In the Apollo programs, when they came inside with their spacesuits and then took the spacesuits off and filled it with air and then took their spacesuits off, then the dust came off the spacesuits into the air, and so they were breathing it. We don't want that to happen in the future. So we want to create technologies to keep the dust out. And we don't think that there's any one technology that can do it. We have to put on a series of battle lines to stop it, prevent it, reduce it every step along the way.
Presumably, a Hoover isn't going to be very effective. You, because of this electrostatic property, there's forces you have to combat as well.
That's right. The van der Waals force and electrostatic forces cause the dust to cling onto surfaces. It can get into the fabric, into the weave of fabrics, and then it wants to cling to those surfaces. And so we're looking at a variety of physical processes to remove it, not only using airflow like a Hoover, but we're also looking at using ion, blowing an ion stream onto the dust in order to electrically neutralize it. We're looking at using magnetic fields. As I mentioned, there's this nanophase iron embedded in the glass coatings on the dust. So the dust is highly magnetic. And so we can use that. We can also use electrostatic techniques. We can charge the surfaces and then rapidly change the voltage on the surfaces to drive the dust off. So some people have been developing these electrodynamic dust screens that will cause the dust to walk along the surface and then fall off the edge. And that's pretty cool. It happens so quickly. It just looks, you turn the switch and the dust just vanishes immediately.
Wow.
And then NASA recently gave some, selected some semifinalists in a competition. I was one of the judges of the competition, looking at a variety of ways to uniquely remove dust from the surface of different objects. Like one group was looking at creating animal fur on the outside of spacesuits, because there are certain animal species that somehow don't get dirty. They were looking at how does the fur as a system function to mechanically and electrodynamically keep dust out of the fur. And so we're looking at biology for biologically inspired solutions.
I mean, I've been doing this program for 11 years. This is such news to me that it is such a big problem and that there are so many people working on different solutions for it. What was our first inkling that this was an issue? Can you tell me a little bit about the dust detection experiments during the Apollo years?
Yeah, so Brian O'Brien was the principal investigator. He was from Australia. He just passed away this past year. But Brian was a never-ending, never-tiring advocate of studying the dust problem. So he built this little tiny experiment. It was just 3 solar cells. But the more dust they got on them, then the less sunlight they would collect. And so it became a measure of the dust. And he designed this experiment to go on the Apollo Lunar Surface Experiment Package, the ALSEP, which was... it was left on the moon. So when the astronauts came back to Earth, it was still there operating for a number of lunar days. A lunar day is 29 and a half Earth days. So anyways, it was collecting data. The sun was rising and falling. And every time the sun came up and down, you could look at the power level going up or down. And he, many, many years later, back in the mid, around 2010, 2009, when he was retiring from the University of Australia, Western Australia at Perth, he rediscovered these data tapes in a cardboard box under a table. And so he resurrected his study of the dust detector experiment, which generated a lot of excitement inside NASA in the United States. Everybody was like, who is this guy? And is this for real? Did he really rediscover these ancient tapes that we thought were lost? And so we had meetings inside NASA talking about it. But yeah, Brian, before his death, he worked year by year for about a decade analyzing those data tapes and made a lot of progress understanding the behavior of the dust every day as the sun would come up and then set again on the moon.
And from that, did we get an understanding of how solar technology might be impacted by this? Because, of course, there's the mechanical problems that can happen when dust jams in joints, for example. But also there's potentially a loss of power to solar cells if this dust sticks on the panels and won't remove and restricts the energy.
Yes, that was precisely what he was seeing. What he noticed was that from the very start of the experiment, the power levels were lower than expected. And what he concluded was that that the astronauts just walking around on the moon was kicking up enough dust that some of it went up to chest level and landed on this experiment. He called that collateral dust. So the discovery of the significance of collateral dust was pretty important. But then what he discovered was that when the Apollo lunar modules left, some of the collateral dust blew off. And so it cleaned the dust experiments, but it didn't clean them completely. But then the next lunar morning, when the sun came up, they got even cleaner. It turns out that the sunlight is a cleaning effect. The bright ultraviolet light charges the dust and it causes the dust to repel itself off the surface. So that's good news that there is a self-cleaning effect on the moon. However, he also argued that every morning when the sun came up, there was a dust storm, because as the sun came above the horizon, the experiments were not seeing as much sunlight as they should have seen until the sun got a few degrees above the horizon. So we argue there's about a 1 meter high dust storm every morning as the terminator line, the line marking between day and night on the moon, as that line passes over your location.
And he just figured that out from the data. Was he proved to be right?
Well, it's still very controversial.
Right.
He published this paper a couple of years ago, and so there was some interest in his theories, but we really have to get back to the moon and get more data before we can settle this. The whole idea that there's natural dust transport on the moon is rather controversial. Some people have argued, no, there's no evidence of any significant dust transport. The dust falls, and wherever it falls, that's where it stays. But others are saying, no, we know it's moving. First of all, impacts on the moon are constantly knocking it around. But also these electromagnetic effects from the sunlight causing it to move around. So there's a number of people studying it in different ways. They're looking from orbit. Can we see the dust moving around on the moon? They're looking at it from these old dust detector experiment data files. And we're also proposing new experiments to go to the moon to take some of these measurements.
Your main area of research isn't specifically this at all, is it, Phil? You look at how soil is affected by landings of spacecraft. I'm wondering, it seems like such a niche area, but I've been to European Space Agency. I've seen these really, really specific and niche problems that a single researcher or a team can be assigned to. Tell me a little bit about your research and why it's so important to think about the soil around a landing site.
So I was part of the team in NASA that was working on space resources. One of the easiest aspects of space resources we think it's the low-hanging fruit. This will be the first thing that we do with resources in space, which is making rocket fuel. So you want to have your rocket land at a gas station and fuel up and then fly away on Mars or on the moon. But to do that, you have to land right next to your gas station. Some of the managers at NASA said, we need somebody to take a look at what does the rocket exhaust do. Does it blow rocks into our gas station? Is it going to sandblast the gas station and ruin it? So they asked me to take a look at that. That was about 23 years ago. And at the time, I think I was the only person in the world studying this problem. And I realized pretty quickly, it's actually a very big problem. It's much bigger than we had realized before. All throughout the 2000s, I was arguing with NASA, trying to prove my point that we need to plan to solve this problem. We need to plan to build landing pads on the moon or on Mars. And we can't just ignore it. There was a lot of reaction against this because building a landing pad on the moon or Mars takes extra missions. And nobody wanted to add extra missions into the timeline because we're talking about billions of dollars to do this. And this is going to delay the entire program by years. So there's a lot of resistance to accepting the fact that we have to do it. But finally, by the end of the Constellation program, around 2010, 2011, the agency had finally started to admit we need to build landing pads on the moon. So now there's a large community growing around the world tackling the problem. We have a lot of people doing computer modeling, trying to understand how rocket exhaust blows in vacuum. So when you get supersonic rocket exhaust expanding into vacuum, it's totally unlike the flows of gas eroding soil here on the Earth. We don't understand the turbulence. We don't understand the boundary layer flow. We don't understand what scales the erosion rate. And we also don't understand the bulk effects. When does the rocket dig a crater versus when does it just scour the surface like during the Apollo landings? So there's a lot of physics that we still have to solve. And so there's a large teams now working on it, trying to get ready for returning to the moon.
This is why they say it's not exactly rocket science. They're not just talking about how much fuel to burn. They're talking about all of these tiny calibrations, experiments, simulations that go together to have a successful mission. Really, really fascinating speaking with you. I never thought I could listen to someone talk about dust for so long. But Dr. Philip Metzger, planetary scientist from the University of Central Florida, brilliant speaking with you. Thanks for your time.
It was my pleasure. Thank you.
He was great, wasn't he? I love the fact that there are so many little industries devoted to solving weird and unexpected problems with space exploration. Right, it's time to look back at some of your comments from last week. And we were talking about vaccines, and Tom McCarthy and Kulak said, great piece on the vaccine. I fully agree with your sentiments. I was moaning about, you know, the situation we're in. And yesterday, Ronan Glynn from Neffert says we need to do more. And that felt like a real kick in the teeth, because I feel like this is Groundhog Day. I don't know about you, but like, come on, dude, like, we need a different approach, I think. I am super frustrated with the numbers. And I was sort of saying, you know, we're seeing these shibbings and all these people behaving in a way that isn't just, you know, taking a reasonable risk. You know, there are people who go out, you know, for a run outside with two other people. That to me pales in comparison to the sort of stuff that we saw on St. Patrick's Day, which is just a total two fingers up. There were 14 young women outside drinking, shouting and singing outside a pub in Monkstown. And, you know, obviously shouting, singing, you know, alcohol reducing your sense of risk, but they were shoulder to shoulder. Like, it was just, it's grinding me down. I don't know about you. Anyway, Tom goes on to say, this is happening in the schools. 16 to 18 year olds, 24 to a room, less than 1 meter apart. We wonder why room numbers are rising again. Please banish the lie that COVID doesn't come to school. Well, you know, are we getting that information? I don't seem to see any granularity beyond they're under 45. I mean, maybe there's more detailed information from the daily briefings I'm missing, but whenever I look at on Twitter, it seems to say, look, under 45s was this amount of people. Like, that's a big cohort. Like, do we have any idea if it's, is it teenagers? Is it schools? Surely we should know that by now. Anyway, look, I don't know. I just, just don't get me started, essentially. Jill texted in about our piece on pain. We were talking about a study that showed that if you can manipulate a particular gene that has to do with pain signaling, you can actually dial it up or dial it down. And this could be hugely useful for people with chronic pain. In it, these mice were given a bit of a poke with a brush. Nothing too painful, but you know, a response. They didn't like it. Jill says, I'd rather have that pain than put animals through torture day in, day out. It's been a while since we've had an animal research tech, so I'm just going to dive into that a bit. While research protocols are designed, research across the world is designed to minimize pain to animals and discomfort to animals, and you have to go through a big ethical review. There's two things I want to say. First is, it's a difficult one. Like, I don't know where I stand on it, to be honest, because obviously you are putting a lot of animals through pain. In this particular study, I have to say, it's not, you know, it's not particularly bad, but there are some which are quite extreme in what happens to animals to try and improve human health. So I do get that. That is a question. But the other problem I have is, you know, the protocols aren't always followed. And no matter how much everyone would love to think that their protocols and their health and safety is perfect, humans are humans and they make mistakes. And I've heard of stories, you know, where people have been honest about what happens in some labs, and it's not perfect. Sometimes there are accidents, sometimes animals are put in pain unnecessarily. So look, it's an uncomfortable situation. But yes, I understand your sentiments, Jill. We were talking about Big Brain, this new, well, it's not new, it's been going for 8 years. It's going to be finished in 2 years, an attempt to create a model of the human brain. One person says, we've certainly come a long way since Phineas, but every brain is different, isn't it? So would one model do? Well, I did put that to our guest last week whose name evades me at the moment. They understand that they understand there are limitations, but they're not just working off one brain. And Connor Tobin says, great interview, really hope you follow up on their progress in the future. Yeah, I think we will. I mean, 2 years time, it'll be all over the place, so you'll hear it on every channel, I'm sure, because it'll be a very big story, and it'll transcend just science programming, but we will definitely cover it. So that's it for this week's podcast. Thanks very much for all of your emails and texts and tweets. And thanks, of course, to our production team. They are producer Aidan McKelvey, Simon Keane, Garrett Mulhall, Steve Daunt, and on sound, Steve McLoone. We'll be back with more Future Proof in the podcast feed on Tuesday. Don't miss it. It's a really interesting, quirky study about how to fool a robin into hatching your pointy egg. There's not much more to explain, really. You have to listen to it. It's next Tuesday in your podcast feed. In the meantime, stay curious.
The Future Proof Podcast from Newstalk.
Proudly supported by Science Foundation Ireland. Hashtag believe in science.
Welcome to another round of Drawing Board or Miro Board. Today, we talk brainstorms with UX designer Brian. Let's go. First question. You thought you'd see everyone's idea in the team brainstorm, but you've got a grand total of one. Drawing board or Miro board?
Drawing board, right? Because in Miro, the team can add ideas now or later. And with privacy mode, we can keep them anonymous until they're good to share.
Correct. Next, you need the best way to explain your idea, but all you have is a few sticky notes. Drawing board or Miro board?
Drawing board, because, you know, in Miro, I could record videos, add text, images, links, and digital sticky notes, of course, present my thoughts the way I want.
Right again. Now, you're looking for a past idea you thought was just genius. Only you could find... Oh, there it is. Drawing board or...
Miro. All our finished and unfinished work lives in one place.
And he's won.
Join over 60 million people getting ideas noticed in Miro Brainstorms. Get your first three boards for free at Miro.com. That's M-I-R-O.com.